Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
And Dr. Stephen Phelps is an American physicist, a philosopher, and translator who currently resides in Oregon, United States. He holds a bachelor's degree in physics and philosophy from Stanford University and a PhD in physics with a specialization in cosmology from Princeton University. For 13 years, he conducted research at the Baha'i World Center in Haifa, Israel, where he coordinated the indexing of the Baha'i writings and their translations from Persian and Arabic into English. During that period, he also held research position in the physics department at Technion University in Haifa and published original research on the masses of nearby galaxies. Now, Dr. Phelps serves as a data scientist, drawing on his background in theoretical cosmology. Thank you, Dr. Phelps. Stephen, if you allow me, for speaking with us today. We're very grateful that you accepted our invitation to have this conversation with our podcast audience. I want us to get started by referring to a recent article of yours with the interesting, or maybe I should say provocative, title of The Harmony of Science and Religion. I'm saying provocative because historically, most people's perceptions of science and religion has been that they inhabit separate worlds, addressing separate sets of questions and using different means to gather knowledge and insight. You know, as I was growing up, I remember quite well, and maybe this is something that you and I share in common, I don't know, but I remember the story of Galileo and the difficulties that he faced with established religious institutions of the day. You know, that made a very strong impression on me. So my first question is this. Is that ancient conflict partly explained by a misunderstanding of the aims and methods of science and religion?
Well, thank you so much, Augusto, for having me on your show. It's an honor to be here. It's a great question. The opening question should take us somewhere in the direction of asking about our definition of terms. Because, of course, any conflict between ideas can at least superficially be solved by a suitable redefinition of terms. What I would like to propose is not so much a redefinition of the term science or how we understand the aims and methods of science, which I think there's much greater consensus on, but rather what do we really mean when we talk about religion and the phenomenon of religion? Because we can talk about religion as it has evolved institutionally over the millennia, and how many people think of religion when they hear the word as a kind of social organization, or as I would prefer, we can talk about religion at a deeper level as to what kind of worldview it represents, because it's that clash, that potential clash of worldviews, that I'm more interested in. Rather than the clash between an existing social organization and the aims and methods of present day science. So if I could just take a stab at that, if we try to ask, and it's an impossible question to answer, but if we try to ask what is the underlying worldview of religion that might put it on a collision course with a scientific worldview, we might go back to what Carl Jaspers called the axial age of religions, a time a few hundred BC, when a very definite conception of the world is divided into something above and something below emerges and becomes central to how religiously motivated people see the world. You know, we are here in this world below, and we want to get to a spiritual world. We want to ascend to a world which is fundamentally distinct from this world. And this division of the world, this axial division into the world, into a lower and an upper, can give rise to a kind of a metaphysics, a way of understanding the world, which is fundamentally dualistic. And this dualistic metaphysics was very much formalized and trademarked, you might say, by Descartes. And I don't want to deny that there's a certain usefulness in dividing the world as we perceive and experience it into a kind of a spiritual domain and a physical domain, just as it's very useful wherever we're situated to define forwards and backwards. You know, forwards and backwards are very well-defined concepts in relationship to where we're sitting. But the concept of forward and backward itself is relative to the sitter. And I would like to suggest that spirit and matter can be thought of in similar terms, that we can think of spirit and matter as more a directionality of consciousness than as a kind of two different sorts of substances. And this can help us, I think, address this perceived conflict between science and religion. In particular, I'd like to suggest that spirit, what we think of as spirit, is not so much a different kind of substance, which then raises this problem of, well, what is the causal relationship between the operations of that spiritual substance in the physical world? And then we land directly into this potential conflict with the scientific worldview. But if we think rather as spirit as the direction of consciousness in the world, or even in the universe as a whole, we can think of progress, the progress that we see in civilization over the last several centuries, the emergence of life in the universe, the coalescing of stars and galaxies out of this primordial soup of the Big Bang. We can think of all of this as the expression of spirit in the realm of matter, this progressive unfolding of consciousness. And so from this perspective, then, we may not see different religions as competing dogmatic systems, but as a single, let's call it, force impelling the development of consciousness. Why do we do this? Because this force ultimately is a creative force. This impelling this consciousness that emerges is what the Greek philosophers, what Christian theologians call the divine logos. It essentially is self-created. It's both the origin and the end of all things. How does this help us with this problem, with the conflict between science and religion? It presents, instead of there being two separate causal frameworks that we somehow have to understand how they relate to each other, it presents instead the idea of there being a single interconnected causal framework that includes what we call bodies and minds.
Thank you, Stephen. That is really a very, very sort of compelling way to begin this conversation. Those are very, very insightful thoughts. As you know, at the Global Governance Forum, we're interested in promoting or strengthening the mechanisms of international cooperation. So many of the problems that we face today, from climate change to biodiversity loss, war and violence, the arms race, issues of poverty and income disparities, all of these problems, are global in nature. And it is difficult to envisage solutions to these problems outside of a framework of much stronger cooperation than we have seen in past decades. And part of the reason why we seem to be unable to do this effectively, and as a result of this, put our future at risk, may have to do with our failure to grasp the connection between scientific and technological progress on the one hand, and human values on the other. The traditional domain, at least as I understand it, of the world's major religions. Right? So your article to me was interesting from the perspective of helping us bridge that gap of understanding, how could having a more rational understanding of what you call the science, the harmony of science and religion, contribute in some way to addressing some of these global challenges? So in a way, I guess what I'm trying to do is trying to bring down the sort of high-level philosophical discussion that you kicked off this podcast with in my answer, in your answer to my first question, you know, to this level of practicality.
Yes. I would say a couple of things in relation to that. I think part of the problem we're facing is that from the perspective of science, we think of human values, particularly human values that are religiously motivated, as being fundamentally arbitrary, not connected to reality as it is, but a kind of dogmatic formulation that's imposed upon people, maybe for the sake of power or control. If instead we think of religion and religious values not as an arbitrary construct of power relationships, but as an expression of the essential relationships that proceed from the realities of things. This is actually a definition of religion that is found in the Baha'i writings, which is very connected, I think, to this idea of spirit being the direction of consciousness. Then it helps to situate and ground human values in something which is based in reality. A second thing I would suggest is that a vision of religion is helpful over and above a secular vision of the world, which sees there being really fundamentally no purpose to the events that happen in the world. From the spiritual point of view of spirit being aligned with the emergence and evolution of consciousness over history, there is a direction to history that events in the universe at large enough scales and long enough time spans follow the direction of consciousness. Although when you zoom in, everything looks random. If you look at, say, the molecular activity within a cell and the individual atoms jiggling around, you can't see any purpose there. But if you zoom out, you start to see more and more the emergence of purpose, that cellular functions are fulfilling a purpose in relation to the body, that bodies, individual organisms, people are moving in purposive ways. But you have to kind of zoom out to see that purpose emerge. It's almost as though we need a sort of complementary laws, you know, a law complementary to the second law of thermodynamics, which is entropy, which is everything breaks down, which is there's kind of randomness eventually takes over. Complementary to that, we need a sort of second law of complexity, the idea that complexity is constantly emerging, consciousness is constantly emerging. These two ideas, I think, help us to imagine human values as being grounded in reality rather than being arbitrary.
In your article, The Harmony of Science and Religion, which I referred to earlier on, you present the broader viewpoint that religion and science are interdependent. I was intrigued by the quote that you cite from Abdu'l-Bahá that states, I quote, "Religion and science are intertwined with each other and cannot be separated. These are the two wings with which humanity must fly. One wing is not enough. Every religion which does not concern itself with science is mere tradition, and that is not the essential," unquote. Often in scientific conversations, it seems to me, religion is seen as based upon myths and you know, without a respected, rigorous intellectual foundation. And this feeling of suspicion, I think, is mutual because, you know, you talk to religious leaders they will often emphasize that scientific development needs the guiding hand of human values to avoid, for instance, you know, what we see today in many different parts of the world, the malignant use of scientific knowledge to create ever more sophisticated weapons of mass destruction and, you know, other evil purposes. And so from this, what do you think about the role that religion can play in the search for solutions to some of the global challenges that, that we confront, which I referred to in my previous question?
I suppose I would start by suggesting what role religion can't or shouldn't play, and then say what it should play. I don't think it is helpful for us to think of religion, true religion, not the structures that have human generated structures that have emerged, but true religion, not so much as a detailed source of knowledge in the sense of information, but rather in the sense of providing solutions by way of taking what is black and white and making it color. There's an image that's found in the Baha'i writings, but also in Islamic scriptures about the essential act of religious insight being something like, so different from knowledge and information, in the sense that knowing about fire, reading about fire in a book, understanding the chemical reactions behind fire is true knowledge of fire at one level, but being burned by the fire is knowledge at another level. Studying the notes of music on a page, studying music theory, understanding chord progressions and all the complexity of that is understanding music at one level, but at a very different level is listening to that music and being lifted up, being transformed into ecstasy by listening to it. I think similarly, the role that religion can play in the search for global solutions is not so much reading out of it a detailed blueprint for action, but rather delivering to humanity a deeply rooted awareness of the interconnectedness of things, an awareness of interconnectedness, which then gives rise to true empathy, desire to understand the other, desire to relate to the other, that bridges not just to one's literal physical neighbor, but across continents, across oceans, something that can embrace the entire world. And this deeply rooted awareness, this capacity of the spirit of religion to translate and transform and transmute human consciousness in this way, it's not something that has to take place across all 7 billion people on the planet. That would be, I think, too optimistic of a demand. Rather, it is a few people that are so transformed that can change the character of a society or a civilization. It's the leaven that leavens the lump. It's I wouldn't call it magic, but it's magical in a way. This ability of inspired souls to change the lives of thousands of people. And so my first point, I guess, would be not to see religion so much as a specific source of solutions, but rather as that leaven that transmutes consciousness that enables different kinds of social and even governance structures and economic structures to emerge that will follow a different kind of set of constraints than we're currently operating into. And those structures, as is in the past, religion has inspired many kinds of social structures, and many problems have been solved by these social structures, but other problems have arisen. In the past, religiously inspired social structures tended to be more top-down and authoritarian and clergy-driven. But I believe the religious future of humanity involves not so much a top-down and authoritarian kind of framework, but something which is much more democratic in spirit, something which is not at all clergy-driven. Because ultimately, these sorts of structures best unlock individual human potential. And this connects back to the first point I made, that the unlocking of individual human potential is the best means of advancing consciousness. And ultimately, if it's about consciousness, if the story of the universe is the story of unfolding consciousness, then when we analyze problems of the day at a global level, if we can see those problems in light of this story of evolving consciousness, it gives us not so much specific solutions to implement, but rather an overall directionality that we know we're aiming at.
Thank you, Stephen. That's fascinating. Very, very eye-opening. Let's continue on your article. I was interested in your discussion on the mind and its effects on human order and interaction. You state that the mind cannot transcend the higher reality that gave it a specific plan in its creation, because you say the highest level of human attainment is the recognition of human inability, something that, you know, resonates very, very powerfully with me. I agree with that. This means that the work of the mind defines the organization of the human population as well as the form of its laws. And from this, you say the pervasiveness of the mind allows for the universe to be intelligible and for law to be based upon rational thought. In reading this, you know, I was considering how this concept can be applied in rethinking our kind of global geopolitical organization. Do you see a connection between religious principles and global governance? And if so, can I tempt you to speculate a little bit on what guidance such principles could give us to how to rethink our currently flawed global order, which seems to be on a path leading to civilizational collapse? Maybe I'm being a bit pessimistic, but you know, when you look at the international outlook on multiple fronts, you know, it doesn't seem like an unreasonable assumption for the near-term future.
In a world where mind is not fundamentally operative, in a world in which at its base, reality is comprised of the essentially undirected movements of atoms and physical forces. In such a world, it seems like the best that we can do when it comes to imagining things like systems of global governance is a kind of, you know, stable equilibrium between competing forces which are fundamentally self-serving in their origin. If, however, we think of mind, or what the ancient Greeks would call logos, as an ordering principle behind the universe, not in its external dualistic sense of there being an imposition of laws from the outside, but this is something which emerges and is part of the structure of physical law itself. If we think of mind or logos as both the origin and the end of things, then that has, I believe, very definite and concrete consequences for how we think about global order and what its goals ought to be. You know, what should be the goal of governance in such a universe? A universe which we see to be a product of mind, and a universe which is aiming towards the fuller efflorescence of mind. In that sort of universe, we would imagine that the goals of governance would be human flourishing, of course, anyone would say that, but human flourishing, which particularly means not simply maximizing material benefits and maximizing material comforts, but maximizing consciousness, whatever that might mean, because it doesn't mean the same thing for every individual. What it would mean is our goals for governance would be unlocking individual human potential to the maximum extent. And this would have implications for the kinds of governance structures that we imagine would best suit that overall picture of the universe. For example, a governance structure which is essentially authoritarian, which tends to enforce a high degree of conformity, would be one which does not advance consciousness as well as a governance structure which tends to encourage, rather, individual free expression, which is why I think, on the balance, democratic structures, for all their messiness and for all of the great troubles that are produced from them, especially in free markets with the releasing of all of the animal spirits and the great inequalities that ensue from that, I would argue that even including all of these disadvantages of these messier democratic governance structures, they are, on the balance, they do better to unlock the true power and diversity of individual human potential than more authoritarian modes of governance.
I think I would agree with that. Certainly the data seems to suggest that you see a lot more innovation, scientific and technological innovation, in societies that are operating under systems of democratic governance. Actually, at the Global Governance Forum, I do a parenthesis here, we have done some research that actually shows that democratic forms of government are actually much more sensitive, for instance, to the status of women. Authoritarian regimes basically coexist with a much greater level of repression and discrimination against women. So that's another angle on the point that you have just made. I was struck in your article by a quote where we are admonished, I think it is Abdu'l-Bahá whom you're quoting, to show forth kindness and mercy to all and to overlook certain shortcomings, that differences may be dispelled, that true harmony be established, and the censure and reproach, the hatred and dissension seen among the peoples of former times may not rise anew, unquote. To me, it seems this is a very relevant thought, living in a time of seemingly endless global conflict, political polarization, distrust in our established institutions. One can understand and see the importance of tolerance and appreciation for the diversity of thought. And so the question is, how can this principle be translated into our day-to-day reality? What can we learn from this in our modern political discussions? It seems to me this is especially relevant in the United States because of the outsized influence of the U.S. in terms of, the global economy, its political footprint on the planet, the role that it has had in shaping the institutions in the last 75 years that have led to our current global order.
This question of diversity it's absolutely a way in which, certainly as envisioned in the Baha'i writings, and this quote was actually by Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith, a way in which the religion of the future is envisaged to look and feel and be experienced very differently from religion of the past. In particular, it is not about, in the end, the imposition of some universally correct dogma or system of beliefs. It's not even the willing embrace by everyone on the planet of a single correct dogma or system of beliefs, but rather the religion of the future is a religion of inclusion, a religion in which a persistent diversity of perspectives that reaches down to the very roots of how we see the world is what characterizes it. And a celebration and embrace of this diversity of perspectives. Because again, linking it back to the original point I made, it is through such a celebration and embrace of diversity that consciousness and its development is maximized in the world. This embrace of diversity is fundamental to the spiritual teachings, even the mystical teachings of the Baha'i faith and of writings of Baha'u'llah that talk about the spiritual path of the seeker as comprising various valleys or various cities, various stages in the journey. And Baha'u'llah talks about these stages as being characterized by certain ways of looking at the world. Through certain valleys, Baha'u'llah describes the seeker seeing the world through the eye of distinction, seeing things divided into this and that, seeing this prophet and that prophet as preaching a fundamentally different message, seeing this person and that person as being fundamentally in a state of competition. But in other stages of the spiritual journey, one sees through the eye of unity, in which no distinction is seen between one soul and another soul, or between one religious message and the other, despite, of course, their being so different from each other in certain externally superficial ways. But the important thing is that for Baha'u'llah, these differences are characteristic of humanity and to be embraced rather than wished away or forced away by some sort of dogmatic imposition. Rather, we understand fundamentally that everyone is in a different place, that everyone has a different way of looking at the world, and that these different ways of looking at the world contribute to our strength. The analogy of the human body is often given in the Baha'i writings, and it is the diversity of and differentiation of the different cells and organs in the body that makes it so powerfully unlock the hidden potential that is present. If we were all, I don't know, a big lump of seaweed or something, we wouldn't, you know, with the same mass, we wouldn't be able to accomplish nearly as much as we can with this highly differentiated symphony of cells and organs that comprise us. It's that diversity that unlocks the power and that enables higher degrees of consciousness to be expressed. Of course, we shouldn't take the analogy of the body too far, because the individual autonomy of the cells of the human body is not that great. They're all pretty much along for the ride and directed by the brain in a way. They have certain autonomous functions, but when we think of the body, we don't think of it as a whole bunch of cells doing their own thing, you know, with some loose organization. It's a very, the analogy of the body, I think, tends to minimize the degree of autonomy of the individual parts. Whereas a future global civilization that has maximized the ascent of consciousness by maximizing the freedom of individuals within the constraints given by the material limits of the planet. A religion that enables this kind of individual autonomy to flourish to its maximal degree will be one that not only is a more diverse religion, and that preserves and celebrates the intrinsic diversity of the planet, but it will also be one which sees an acceleration in the advance of consciousness.
Fascinating, Stephen. Thank you. Thank you for that. It's most interesting. One person that had some influence in my sort of early intellectual development was the philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell. And a very fun book to read if you haven't read it is his autobiography. In this book, he relates an episode when he witnessed the wife of a fellow colleague at Cambridge University, a mathematician by the name of Alfred Whitehead, suffer intense pain due to some heart problems. And this caused Russell to have what one might describe today, you know, as a kind of a moment of spiritual insight. And I'd just like to share how he describes that moment, you know, when he sees Whitehead's wife, you know, gripped in pain. He said, "The ground seemed to give way beneath me, and I found myself in quite another region. Within 5 minutes, I went through such reflections as the following. The loneliness of the human soul is unendurable. Nothing can penetrate it except the highest intensity of the sort of love that religious teachers have preached. Whatever thus does not spring from this motive is harmful or at best useless. It follows that war is wrong, that the use of force is to be deprecated, and that in human relations one should penetrate to the core of loneliness in each person and speak to that." Unquote. Can you comment on the relevance of this insight for the main thesis of your article, and in fact of the, you know, the things that you have been saying so insightfully during the last half an hour?
I love Russell too. And Whitehead. I especially love Russell's final comments he made, and this is captured in video. You can find it on YouTube, where they ask him sort of at the end of a long life, you know, of philosophizing and thinking deeply about things. What do you want the future to know? What advice would you give people? And he had a couple of things to say. One of them was don't believe something just because it's useful. Believe something only because it is true, which I might have some disagreement with. But the point that I completely agreed with him on, related to what you just said, was love is wise and hatred is foolish. I love this example you gave because it shows that this recognition of the wisdom of love is it's not necessarily a rational step to take. Not saying it's irrational, anti-rational, but it can't be reached by rational argumentation. It requires a kind of intuitive leap. And I think it's important to point out that attempts to harmonize science and religion, I don't think will succeed by flattening religion and making it completely rational. There is a three-dimensionality that has to be retained. And the insights that come from religions and religious systems and the great religious figures that have inaugurated those systems are not fundamentally philosophical intuitions that can be derived from reason. Even if we believe reason and mind and an ordering principle underlies all things, there is a kind of way in which the great prophets of history are so far ahead of us on the curve, so to speak, that what may seem reasonable to them, what to them is simply an expression of their underlying intuition of things that comes from their perception of reality, to us seems quite arbitrary. So we call it divine revelation. We think of it as something that almost literally comes down from above. But ultimately, it comes from a kind of reason that may not be accessible to us. To us, it seems like a leap. How do we make that leap, though? One way, and perhaps the most powerful way that leap is made, and it connects so much and so beautifully to what Russell said in this quotation, is through human relationships. It's through this deepening love of our neighbor, which is really, it's really no different than the message of Christ from 2,000 years ago. The religion of the future, I think, is not going to be fundamentally any different from the essence of Christianity or the essence of Buddhism. There is, and this is also a statement made in the Baha'i writings, that everything in religion changes. All the laws and ordinances, even the theological systems change. There's only one unchanging, constant, eternal principle behind it all, and that's the law of love. This law of love is not just a human law either. I mean, it's a law that operates between the atoms. It's a law that operates throughout all 13.7 billion years of cosmic history. And we see that love operating in the coming together of things in ever more complex configurations, if we look at it physically. Of course, if we look at it through the eyes of love, we're not seeing complex configurations of atoms when we're loving our neighbor. We're recognizing that there's a divine spark within the other, which is the same as that divine spark that resides within us, and which gives us a kind of inherent nobility. And that inherent nobility, which is a nobility that we all have by virtue of our partaking of this divine logos. We are all expressions of this mind of the universe that is this, both the source and the goal of all things. That is ultimately provides us with a deeper ground of love and unity than otherwise we would get through merely rational processes. And this is an extraordinarily counterintuitive thing to say, because the everyday world that we navigate and experience is a world of separate competing things. People are in competition for, and societies, tribes, races, religions, nations are in competition in this physically bounded world for scarce resources. And our everyday conception of the world is that it's divided into these separate things that the law of the struggle for survival is operative within. But seeing through the eye of the spirit, one sees ultimately the interconnectedness underlying these things. And it's a counterintuitive claim, because those invisible threads of interconnection that unite one heart with another, that unite one religion with another, one race with another, are invisible. They cannot be seen or measured with our scientific apparatuses. That doesn't mean that ultimately the connectivity is the rule rather than the exception, that the connectivity between souls and peoples and indeed every atom of existence is the rule of the universe. We are all part of an entangled web of relationships. And one great expression of the perception of that entangled web of relationships is a deepening sense of love for one's neighbor.
Wonderful, wonderful, Stephen. Let's conclude this podcast, which has been, I don't think I exaggerate if I say a tour de force. Let me come back one last time to an issue which was touched upon in some of my earlier questions. The role of science in coming decades in helping us find solutions to some of these, you know, critical problems that I have alluded to, climate change, economic disparities, and so on, is perhaps, maybe I'm wrong, reasonably well defined. Our scientists may not always succeed in persuading our politicians to do the right thing, but for instance, in thinking about climate change, it's not knowledge that is lacking. I think it is political will. And so my question to you to conclude is, what is the corresponding role of religion in helping us to better understand how to better govern our increasingly interdependent global community of nations.
So I would also go back and touch upon an earlier point I made, which is, I think, worth underlining. And that is that the role of religion in the future, and this is partly, I think, what makes it really difficult for us to think objectively about religion and its potential role. Because if we look back in history, we see the role of religion as primarily authoritarian in its form and execution, or theocratic. And we see at present a continuing attempt to impose those conceptions of religion on present-day social orders. But the attempt to do so runs aground against the great, I will call them, spiritual lessons of the Enlightenment of the last few centuries. Dare to know, dare to question authority, because we all have a mind which is capable of understanding the universe. And we cannot turn back the clock by looking to older modes of governance, older modes of thinking, when we've passed through this transformative period of enlightenment, which has unfolded to us an understanding of the world, which is quite different from the understanding we had prior. We now see that the world runs according to regular, predictable, in many cases, physical laws. This is the world we inhabit. And it's a world that can be greatly unlocked and brought to heal and by the operations of the mind. And so if we can't turn back the clock, though, to earlier forms of governance, we don't really have a model for the future. So it's difficult for us to imagine what the future will look like. But my guess would be that it's going to be something like a spiritualized democracy, in the sense that it will be based on the fully realized spiritualized individuals. And I say spiritualized because if we imagine, this is blue sky thinking for the moment. If we imagine a future civilization in which a leaven has been brought and has leavened the lump, so to speak, that small minority of individuals with a transformed consciousness of the interrelatedness of things actually touches civilization and changes its character in some fundamental way, then the kinds of constraints which forced religious and governmental and economic systems to take certain shapes in the past may not be operable in the same way going forward. In other words, if we had to assume that the individual was, on the whole, operating according to self-interest, that constrains, for example, the kind of governance and economic systems that are going to be effective in such a world. If we have a world in which individuals, in the main, are no longer primarily motivated by self-interest, that will open up entirely different modes of governance that don't exist today. And indeed, if we were to say what they were, if we somehow had a time machine, were able to go forward a few hundred years and get the constitution of those governance structures and bring it back, probably people would laugh, because they would say, this is utopian nonsense. There's no way that this would work. Because the only way it will work, the only way these future governance structures will work, is in the context of a spiritualized and spiritually transformed humanity. And I don't mean that in the utopian sense of every single person on the planet, because that's never going to happen. It's a matter of a critical mass of people will be enough to change the character of the world. And this spiritualized democracy will be based on just a few basic principles. Consult on the problems that are in front of you. Consult in good faith on the problems that lie before you. Act in unity. And and bring in a diversity of viewpoints into that consultation. And so the consultative process, the governance process, will be less centralized in powerful individuals and more located in small groups of individuals, small enough to work as a consultative body, but large enough to include enough, a critical mass of that diversity of perspectives that enables the maximum number of viewpoints to be expressed, the maximum number of dimensions to be explored. The Baha'i writings talk about consultative bodies with a minimum of 9 members. It can be more than this, but they say around 9 is the ideal minimum for these sorts of consultative structures. These are the sorts of general visions of the future, which not specific, and these aren't specific blueprints that say exactly what have to be done. These are just a few principles. If, as I think all the religions of the world have intimated, as the Baha'i writings explicitly state, ultimately mind is the source and the goal of all things, that gives a direction to things, that gives then a sense of directedness to how we should self-organize on this planet, that will in the end have something to do with maximizing the spiritual flourishing of individuals. And that has to take place through structures that are maximally inclusive, that respect and celebrate diversity, that engages diversity in meaningful ways, that is based upon a consultative framework, and that also provides a basis for unity of action going forward. A unity, however, that is not destructive of the individual opinions and the diversity of opinions, which will continue to exist even within the framework of unified action.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.